You're listening to the London Buddha Centre, talks and seminars from our home in Bethnal Green, exploring Buddhism in a way that is relevant to contemporary life.
So, for a while, I felt like I pulled the short straw on this list of talks. It's Christmas Day. We've just had such a nice, lovely day. Some of you were making an energy circle at the top of the hill this afternoon. We had energy circles in the morning. We've had this amazing meal and vegan pastries at breakfast. Wasn't that such a nice day? And then now I'm going to talk about suffering. And not just suffering, I'm also going to talk about renunciation. So I thought I'd tell you that straight off so it doesn't come as a shock. Yes. But I think these are important things because what it is that basically Buddhism starts with experience. Buddhism starts with experience and it starts with the mind. So it doesn't start with an idea of how things could be. It just starts from how things are. Yeah? How things are. And as Paramabandhu said yesterday, in the human realm, there's pleasure. Nothing wrong with pleasure. Hopefully, after a day like today, you will know that there's Buddhism doesn't have anything against pleasure. In fact, being able to enjoy pleasure in a healthy way is extremely important. We need to be able to do that, yeah? And also, in the human realm, there is pain, yeah? So I am going to start by introducing a couple of Pali words, Sanskrit words, and it's sukha. Sukha is pleasure, and dukkha is suffering, yeah? So I do need to be a little bit careful here. Hopefully you'll be able to follow this. Because in one good way to think about pain and suffering, and I am going to try to differentiate between them, is that pain is inevitable. In the human realm, pain is inevitable. We will experience pain. But what is optional is suffering, yeah? So suffering, this kind of dukkha in the sense of suffering is optional. So those of you who have been doing the homework, you know, watching your reactive mind, watching when you're in creative mind, you might have noticed that there are different flavors of dukkha. You know, there'll be different flavors of suffering. And it will be on the basis of an aversion, there's a painful experience, we don't want it, and we react. Yeah? So maybe by this time in the retreat, your knees might have started hurting. And if you're not careful, if you're not mindful in meditation, what you might end up doing, which I have definitely in the past, is just spend your whole meditation thinking about how you're going to get through the next 6 or 7 or however long your retreat is. And that's your whole meditation. My knee hurts, and oh my God, how am I going to get through this sit? How am I even going to get through, you know, the next X number of days? And I don't want to make a noise by moving. I don't want to disturb the people around me, but my knee's killing me, and I bet I'm going to be crippled by the end of this meditation. Yeah? And another flavor of dukkha is the dukkha of change. The dukkha of change, and that's usually based on craving. We want something that we don't have, and when we have it, we're worried that it will go away. So maybe you're conscious of this really good-looking guy, or a good-looking woman, or a good-looking person on this retreat, and you're sort of trying to find a way of getting into their presence. But you're doing that in meditation, which obviously you can't. And then when you're in a conversation with them, you're worried that it will end. So that's like another kind of suffering. It might be a person, it might be plum jam, you know. Or, Or you might have had another kind of dukkha, another sort of flavor of dukkha, which is the dukkha, it's kind of like an existential dukkha, a kind of suffering that arises from our fundamental misunderstanding of things. It can be quite hard to talk about, but again, it can arise in meditation, or it might arise out of meditation as well. The sense of something not quite being right. I tend to experience it as a kind of existential loneliness, that I'm alone, which I know is a wrong view, is a misunderstanding of the way things are, but it definitely feels like that, that I'm alone, and I'm slightly homesick for something, I don't know what. Definitely not my flat, definitely not Malaysia where my parents are. Something, yeah? And dukkha can arise in relation to quite small things. It might be just that somebody doesn't look at us, somebody doesn't acknowledge us, or somebody says something off the hand and it hurts us. And we know that, you know, it shouldn't, but it does. Or suffering can arise from really terrible things. Terrible things do happen that are completely out of our control. They can arise because of other people. They can arise because of world events. They can arise because the earth shifts, there's an earthquake, and we lose everything. So there's a whole spectrum of suffering as well. And I think it's quite good to know that. Garbhavati was saying to me, one of the things that's important about this teaching of suffering is that sometimes we can think that because we're suffering or because there's pain, we're doing something wrong. But actually, it's not that we're doing something wrong. There just is. Yeah? There's nothing we've done wrong. It's not because we're bad people. Fundamentally bad people. And it's quite important, I think, particularly in today's world of Facebook and Instagram, sometimes we can get into this mode where it's as if suffering's not okay. We have to curate our brand on Facebook, or curate, even like at work, all the time we have to be on message, on brand, you know. We just have to be like the happy version of ourselves, and as if suffering doesn't exist, yeah. So, where am I going with all this? So, one of the things that I want to say about suffering is that when we're in reactive mind, what we're doing is that we're adding to our pain. Yeah? We have an experience that triggers a painful feeling within us, and when we're in reactive mind, we add to our pain. And we add to it in quite a lot of different ways, usually by just distracting ourselves and abstracting from our experience. So what we can do, I'm just talking about myself maybe, but I get away from my difficulty by blaming other people. I can also get away from my difficulty from getting very, very busy so that I don't have to think about what's difficult in my life. Or sometimes, and this might be quite subtle, but I can also apply the Dharma in quite a superficial way. Yeah? So, what do I want to do? So, what I want to move on to now is now that we've identified, well, we spent the last couple of days just identifying reactive mind and identifying suffering, but I want to say a little bit more about how you might want to practice with it. And really, the basic practices are mindfulness and metta. So when we're in reactive mind, when we're in dukkha, What we need to do is to see if we can track back to the basic discomfort. So one thing that's happened recently is I've had a set of shoes that I really, really like, but they've got holes in them, and it's winter, so it rains a lot. So if I don't check the weather before I leave home, and it happens to rain, my feet get wet. And it's not just that my feet get wet. I have wet socks, and I have to walk around all day in wet socks. And there was one morning when my morning routine is that I wake up, I meditate, and then I go and see my yoga teacher all the way in Houston. And there was one morning where I got caught in the rain. My feet were soaking by the time I got to my yoga teacher's, and then I had to go to work. And I was in a little bit of a mood. In fact, I was in quite a big mood. And by the time, I had to put on my wet socks. And I was just in this big story about, like, oh, I can't believe I'm working at this Buddhist center and they don't pay me enough to get a new pair of shoes. And my feet are wet. And how did I get myself into this situation where I can't afford a new pair of shoes? And by the time I got to the Buddhist center, I felt ready to quit my job, you know? But really, what it was that I didn't check the weather forecast, and I could have put on my wellies. I do have a pair of wellies that are waterproof. But can you see that, you know, what I probably needed to have done in that moment is just gone, oh, Dana Yutal, you're walking around in wet socks. And it is an uncomfortable sensation. It's a sensation that you don't like. And it is just wet socks. You could, you know, ask to borrow a pair of socks. You could just go home and put on fresh socks. But, you know, I just made it into such a big thing that I was about to do something that could really change my life. And, you know, sort of change my good conditions that I'm in. Another thing that I've learned about being on retreat, just another little example, was just about sharing rooms. And over the years, I've been on quite a number of retreats, and I've shared rooms with people who don't snore, and I've also shared rooms with people who snore. In fact, I've not shared a tent with, but you know how when you camp on these camping retreats, the tents are quite close, and I've definitely have had only like a bit of tent between me and the snorer. One of the things I've noticed about myself and being with somebody who snores is that what keeps me awake isn't actually the snoring. In a way, snoring is just a sound in the dark. And I am sometimes afraid of the dark, but not usually. But what keeps me awake is my anxiety about the next day, and then the next day, and then the next day. My anxiety about whether or not I'm going to get back to sleep, and whether or not I'm going to get sleep the next day, and how am I going to meditate if somebody is snoring all night. Actually, that is what keeps me awake. When I'm in a good state and I just think, oh, it's so-and-so, oh yeah, they're just doing that thing, and then I just go back to sleep, it's all right. It doesn't actually keep me awake. So if we can track back to what it is that causes us difficulty, causes us the suffering, we won't be hijacked by it. Can you see what I mean? In that situation with the wet socks, I was just hijacked by the wet socks. In the situation with the snorers, it's just another person. And in a way, it's quite nice to have company. Yeah. So we need to pay attention to our what happens in those moments and see if we can track back to the sources of difficulty. Sometimes somebody can say something which is a little bit cutting, and if we can just realize that, oh, it makes us a bit insecure. It's not that we hate the person, it's the insecurity in us that's uncomfortable. Yeah? And also we can practice the metta bhavna. I think it's really important to practice the metta bhavana in response to suffering. I heard this story some time ago about another order member. They were telling the story about themselves and why they practice. And their story was that they had gone with a good friend to the doctors, and their friend was going to receive quite a painful injection into their spine. And he was there to give a bit of support to his friend. And the friend was lying on the bed, and the doctor put the needle in. And in that moment, his friend reached out to grab his hand, and he flinched. So we practice the metta bhavana so that we don't flinch. We practice the metta bhavana so that we develop a sense of robustness, so that we can have an effect even in the world that's just before us. And I do really believe that the more we turn towards suffering, the more we turn towards dukkha, the more capacity that we develop to face suffering in the world. And it's a bit like in those moments, particularly when we're really up against it, it feels like our heart will break. It feels like we won't be able to bear it. But we do. We do. Impermanence does have a good side. In a moment you'll have another experience and that will be fine. But if we can practice just staying with that heartbreak, we tenderize our hearts, and then we develop a capacity to be with other people's suffering. Checking the time to see if I've got another story. Got time for another story. So sometimes, I hope I can tell this anyway, sometimes in the past, I've had slightly not so good mental health. And that is really heartbreaking at so many levels. It's painful just to know that you can't sort of do very much about it in a particular sort of way. At one level you can, and sometimes you can't. And I remember when I was in a real state and I was talking to my preceptor. I wasn't even ordained then, but this woman who eventually ordained me. And I was just saying, but I feel like I should be able to meditate my way out of it. And she really just empathized with me. And she also said, if you can go through this, in the future, you will be able to be with other people with difficulty. And definitely in the last year, I've felt that. It's a bit like I'm not afraid of other people who might, I don't know whether they do or not, but who might appear to be a bit sort of unsteady or have poor mental health. I don't feel afraid in a particular sort of way. I feel sort of fine, we can talk. So the more we can turn towards dukkha, the more we can be with it, the more we grow our capacity to be with it in ourselves and with other people. So I know this is all getting a little bit heavy, but what I want to do is to turn towards the Buddha in the human realm. So as Parama Bandhu was saying yesterday, the Buddha in the human realm is a mendicant. He is a spiritual person. He is a seeker. He wears a saffron-colored robe. He holds a staff and he holds a begging bowl. And what it's trying to say in the Wheel of Life is that once you're in the human realm, once you're roughly a happy, healthy human being, what you need to do is to live a spiritual life. If you want to grow and develop in this way, What you need to do is see if you can live a spiritual life. In a way, not even see if you can, and you know, just do it. But what is a spiritual life? This is a question that came up in my group today. And I want to start off by saying that actually this thing of what is a spiritual life can be quite difficult to talk about. It's quite a nuanced thing. And sometimes when we talk about living a spiritual life, people can go away with the impression that it's about being ethical in the sense of recycling, or reading The Guardian, or having a particular set of liberal politics. And again, it can just sort of like get into a bit of self-improvement, or it can get into flights of fantasy where we literally believe, I don't know, fantastical things, I guess. But spiritual life, it might look like all those things. It might look like, I don't know, reading poetry. It might look like having a membership or at the Tate or going to it quite a lot. But it's much more than refined aesthetics. It's much, much more than refined aesthetics. Sometimes we can talk in terms of ethics and meditation and wisdom. Or we can talk in terms of like the religious life, but it's not religious in the sense of the ecclesiastical. In a way, it'd be great if all of you wanted to join the order, but even if you don't join the order, you can, and in a way, you must live a spiritual life. When I think about people who I look up to, my teachers, people who have been practicing for a long time, what I often see in them isn't something that's, I don't know, sort of, in some ways supernatural, but in other ways they are extremely human. It's a bit as if they've practiced human decency, practiced being a very sane person, and elevated that sanity to almost like a transcendental level, so that they're just incredibly wise and incredibly kind. And they feel like they've done that by turning towards real issues. So not sort of things that sort of look spiritual, but real issues like transforming the relationships in their lives, transforming by living from their deepest levels of meaning and value that they can be in touch with. Yeah? And they do that in all areas of their lives, not only one particular area. But just to go back to the image of the Buddha in the human realm holds a begging bowl. And when I was researching this talk, and I was thinking about this Buddha holding the begging bowl, I realized that in my own sort of meditation that I do every morning, the Buddha has a begging bowl, and I often forget about the begging bowl. And what the begging bowl symbolizes is renunciation. And I think renunciation, in a way, it can sometimes be the great shadow of Western Buddhism. We don't really seem to like talking about renunciation. It feels too much like giving up all the nice things in life. Yeah. And in a way, it isn't about that at all. Sometimes I think a better word for renunciation might be growing up. What we need to do is just to grow up. And something about growing up is that it's like a natural process. I mean, imagine when you were a baby, you had all these diapers, and you probably had a rattle, and you probably had a dummy. And imagine if you never grew up and out of it. In a way, you've already given up diapers and rattles and nappies. It's sort of the same thing, you know. You just grow up. You grow up and out of the things that we don't need anymore, yeah? And if we did hang on to it, that's where it causes difficulty in our life. Okay. So renunciation could look like giving up stuff. You know, it could look like having a sort of less demanding job so that you have more time for spiritual practice. It might mean living a more simpler life. It might look like living in a Buddhist community rather than a house. But it also might not. In a way, renunciation is an individual thing, and we need to do it in a way, Bhante says, every day more and more of less and less. So every day we do need to practice a little bit of renunciation in a way as preparation for the big renunciation. We will grow old. We will be giving up our youth. We will grow sick. We will be giving up our health. And eventually we will die. We will do the big renunciation of giving up life. But whilst we're alive, in addition to giving up stuff, actually what I think is far more important is to look at the intangibles, the things that we hold on to, like our reputation or a sense of self-worth that we get from our glamorous job, things like that. In a way, those things are also important. So it's not just about giving up stuff. Yeah? We need to also get beyond all these narratives that don't serve us. Okay. So Garbhavati was talking about one of my sort of narratives about myself, which is how I know how to do things. I know how to do things right. And not wrong. And I was just thinking about this quite a lot. And then I think what it is that I've been very fortunate in my life to have had a mother who's an educator. And she's a mother who's interested in teaching. So I've just sort of learned, and I've also learned to learn. So I do, I guess, pick things up well. And then other people tell me that I do things well. But it is, for me, something that I work with, that I build up a sense of myself, but as a person who knows how to do things. And then, when I get things wrong, it's incredibly shocking. So I'll tell you two little stories in connection to that. Just before I came on retreat, one of the things I did was I actually unpacked after 3 months of living in my flat. And I was putting up these pictures, and it was extremely humiliating. So I was doing that with my husband, and I was laughing at the way he was measuring things, because he was just so sloppy. And I did an engineering degree, and like I do know how to measure things. I was teaching him how to measure things. Anyway, we drilled two holes in the wall and tried to put the picture up. And the holes were like 10 centimeters apart. They were exactly 10 centimeters apart, but they were 10 centimeters like in the wrong way. And we couldn't get the picture on the wall. And it was a bit of a shock. He was like, it doesn't go up. And I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean that it doesn't? And I definitely had a moment of, oh. That hasn't happened in a very long time. And it was as if, like, for a moment, I didn't know who I was. But I think, I guess I know enough just to cherish those moments rather than edit them out of my memory, like that never happened. Actually, this very morning, Suvanna Jyoti was pulling me up on my practice of the speech precepts. And I could definitely feel the sense of, like, no. That's not me. In fact, I might even have said to her, No, I didn't do that. But it's good. It's good for me to be humiliated. It's good for me to be... No, it is. It is, really. You know, it's good practice for us to know when we are wrong and know those moments where reality breaks through our defenses. And I think that's what these stories about ourselves are. Because I know how to do things right. Subhana Jyoti, in fact, gave me a cup which says, hashtag source of all wisdom. But when reality breaks through and you just go and go like, oh yeah, I'm not perfect. It's destabilizing and important to cherish. Those are the moments that something else can happen. So that's my particular narrative about myself, but you might have quite a different one. And you might have a narrative of, I'm not good enough. The Dharma's fine, but I'm not up to practicing it. Other people have great conditioning, but I don't. And I'm a terrible person, lots of self-critical stories. But again, I would say that that is also just a narrative. Just like I'm amazing and I'm a rock star is a narrative. And those narratives, we keep them going by editing our experience. So just like I might edit out my mistakes, what might happen if you have self-critical stories is that you don't notice everyone who does love you and does encourage you. You might not notice people wanting to make connections with you. All those things might be edited out. And so you keep yourself isolated, just as I keep myself isolated. And what we do need to do is just to hang loose to these narratives, and even if we can, give them up completely. Give them up completely. Because if we tell ourselves stories about ourselves, I bet you we're doing it about other people. So my story of, like, I know how to do things right also means that other people don't know how to do things right. And in that way, we keep ourselves separate. Me in here, them out there. So I want to tell another little story, and this is a story about being on retreat and being in silence. So I was on a retreat, and I was doing this little job, this little task, and somebody else was doing it with me. So this is an order meditation retreat, and we're in quite far into the silence. And this person was doing this job with me, and then they started chatting to me in the silence. And I got into this whole thing of like, come on, you're in the order. I'm sure you've done as many retreats as I have, probably even more, and why are you talking to me in the silence? And they're just chatting, and they're talking to me in the silence, and that's getting a bit irritated. And also righteously indignant. Some of you might recognize that mental state. And then the work period ended, and we were meditating. So in my meditation, I was doing my usual thing of, maybe not always that usual, but I was a bit distracted. And as it happens, as we all probably do that, you suddenly come to from distraction. So you have this moment of awareness. And then I realized that this person talking to me in the silence is exactly like me talking to myself in meditation. Like, blah, 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 blah. It's exactly the same experience. And in that moment, something happened. And it was a bit like suddenly the experience was one and the same, and they weren't so separate from my own mind. Them talking to me was no different from me talking to myself. And that sort of sense of them out there and me in here was somehow just attenuated for a moment. It was just, boom, gone. And it's not as if, like, I merged into them or they merged into me, but there was a real sense of uplift and energy and joy. Suddenly the tension was all gone. And every time I think about them, or even write to them or see them, which I do quite often, I do a little internal bow, because they showed me the nature of my mind. They showed me something about nature of experience. It was just wonderful, actually. One of the reasons why I'm telling you this little story is because the sense of attenuation between me and them, it was as if that instead of being on opposite sides, suddenly we were on the same side. And when you're on the same side, there are no sides. Obviously, when I say this, it's obvious, but the actual experience of it was profound. And I hope all of you somehow on these retreats will have an experience of that, this kind of the sense of that we don't need to be on a different side to other people. Fundamentally, we are all on the same side. Because as anyone who's met an angry vegan will know, or an angry feminist will know, if we want to change the world, we need to be fundamentally on the same side as other people. At a very, very, very basic level, we need to be on the same side. So if we have any sort of altruistic ambitions, altruistic pretensions even, we do need to be on the same side as other people. So we practice renunciation so that we can be completely free. I want to say something about this, but I'm not sure if I've got time. So maybe I'll just say two things. There are just these two quotes from the Pali Canon, the sort of source text of Buddhism that I love. One is from the Udana, which is, just as the oceans have one taste, the taste of salt, so too does the Dharma have one taste, the taste of freedom. So it's not as if we do this renunciation practice just to, you know, get rid of stuff and get rid of self. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is just to be completely, completely, completely free. And my current sort of, and my current practice, my image of freedom is one of the blue sky. In the blue sky, you can move in any direction. There are no grooves in the blue sky. There's no track that you habitually go down in the blue sky. You can be completely free. Which brings me to my my second favorite thing that I reflect on. I think, the Buddha talking to Mara. Mara is a bit like the Buddha's personification of evil. And it says, by what means will you track him, the trackless one? So that's another epithet of the Buddha, the trackless one, the one who doesn't wear any grooves. By what means will you track him, the trackless one? Okay. So, I've talked about suffering, I've talked about renunciation, talked a little bit about freedom, and I just want to finish by talking about faith. So, sometimes I tell the story on these retreats, but I think it's an important story for me, so I'll just tell it again. I'm really sorry if you've heard this before, but you'll just have to bear with it. So, 11 years ago, I came on this retreat. As a retreatant, and it's true, I did think it was a yoga retreat, and when I got here, I didn't even like the yoga. And in those days, we used to have these retreats at this boarding school in Oxfordshire, and it was shabby, not even shabby chic. And I mean, it had its own particular charm, but it was a bit of a shock to me. So I was coming from my job in the city, which was, you know, the city environment. It's like Steel and glass and people with hair. And they like dress really nicely. And they walk really fast. And here I was in this boarding school. I just really didn't know what hit me. And then I met the man who led the group I was in. And it was one of those things, I just think, well, the stars must have been aligned. Because he not only had a career in the city, he also had a career in this very, very specific area of debt financing that I did. It's a very small niche area, which was the epicenter of the financial crisis. I think there's something about the Buddhas in all these different realms, the human realm, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and so on. There's something about these about the Buddhas that I think they are a little bit like us, but they offer a completely different way of being. And here was Amalavajra leading my group. He was a little bit like me, but he was also completely different. In a way, I was very, very stuck in my job. I couldn't really imagine a life after banking, despite desperately wanting to get out of it. And here was this person who had done it. And he seemed normal and happy and kind of still successful. Good looking and, you know, everything. It's just like, wow, I want to be like that. I want to do that. So I think there's something about faith. Vidyadhaka, a couple of days ago, he asked me, isn't there anything else you would like to be doing, you know, after all this time on the retreat? Isn't there anything else you'd rather be doing at Christmas or New Year? And in a way, there are other things I would like to be doing rather than worrying about the 51 toilets on site and whether or not they've got enough toilet roll in each toilet or, you know, things like that. I would quite like to be in my flat sometimes. On my sofa, I've got a really big sofa. But there's something about putting myself in conditions where I water my faith, a bit like watering a plant, just being in touch with the deepest truths that resonate in my heart. And not just being in touch with those truths, being around other people who are in touch with those truths, in touch with something that's completely other, and bearing witness to other people, doing all those little things of transformation, that's those simple things from moving from reactivity to something different. Just watching other people open up, watching other people stay with their heartbreak, watching other people be kind to each other and help each other. It inspires me and it moves me. And then the third aspect of faith is just that I'm able to, in these conditions, to act in ways that close the gap, even if it's a little bit, it close the gap a little bit with the vision. And that's why I come on these retreats. And that's why I practice. Faith is sometimes translated as the ultimate in us resonating with the ultimate in the universe. The ultimate in us resonating with the ultimate in the universe. And what I want to do with my life is I want to keep the resonance going.
You've been listening to the London Buddha Center. make sure to press the subscribe button, and then please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It really helps other people to find us. Thank you.